Welcome to Real Talk, Real Estate Discussions with Andrew Kirsch. In each episode, Andrew interviews industry leaders. We'll hear their real-time opinions on today's market, their background and unique career highlights, and guidance for newcomers into the industry. You can find this show at scholarkirsch.com and on YouTube, LinkedIn, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and more. Now here's the host of Real Talk, Andrew Kirsch.
Episode 49 of Real Talk. This week, it was my honor to have Mark Gibson from JLL, the CEO of Capital Markets Americas, on the podcast. Mark is a well-known titan in our industry. He came on to speak about the state of the global market, the real estate market, how he's starting to see some capitulation in the market, people, especially institutions, coming back to the market. And what's interesting is having our podcast, hearing him speak about what he's seen and the data points that JLL is tracking is consistent with what we're seeing at Sklar Kirsch. The last 30 to 45 days, a significant increase in deal volume, LOIs, PSAs, transactions. The conversation has now included, I don't want to say replaced, because we're still talking about loan modifications and workouts and note purchases, but it is now including actual deal flow, which is nice to see. I hope you enjoy my conversation with Mark Gibson. Welcome to another edition of Real Talk. I'm here with Mark Gibson, CEO of JLL Capital Markets Americas. Mark, how are you doing today?
All good, Andrew.
So Mark, we met at a YPO conference for multifamily in San Antonio about 6 weeks ago or so. And prior to the conference, all the attendees and fellow panelists were so giddy and excited to hear that Mark Gibson was coming. How'd you get Mark Gibson to come on to our YPO conference? And now I can only imagine the listeners of our podcast are going to have the same excitement that Mark Gibson is on Real Talk. So I truly appreciate it.
I think it goes downhill from there, Andrew. So just so you know, maybe low expectations there, but it's a privilege to be here. Actually, it's the other way around. So thank you for inviting me and looking forward to a good conversation.
I really enjoyed our conversation in San Antonio. And I'm just going to start by asking you, based on the position that you're in at JLL and what you're seeing, you know, or let me ask it in an open-ended question. What are you seeing in the real estate market as we had just finished the first quarter of 24 and we're entering the second quarter here?
Well, you got to take a step back, I think, to gain a little perspective. One is that anytime we have a significant change in capital markets, whether it's real estate oriented or not real estate oriented, let's just say things that affect the bond market and the stock market, or the fixed income market and the stock market, you tend to have a pause. Those pauses vary depending upon what we're dealing with at the time. It could be geopolitical issues. It could be, as we've had this time, a little bit of both. We've had rapid rise in the cost of capital vis-a-vis the Fed actions to stem inflation. And you've also had other concerns globally, which are pretty consistent in every cycle in some form or fashion. There's always risk. There's always some concern. But you had that. And in this case, people essentially went into a holding pattern for an extended period of time. Generally, we see that for 6 months. This time, it was more like 18 months because they could not figure out which way the market was going to go. Are we going to get inflation under control? Therefore, is there a reasonable path for a normalization of the yield curve? So I think most people have chatted about that fairly extensively. To answer your question on the first quarter and where we stand, I think people have rationalized to the following position. One is they see plus or minus basis points, the 10-year bond settling in and around 4%, generally speaking. They do see the yield curve normalizing, meaning the short end of the curve coming down over time, Question is, what time? But from the largest owners of capital perspective, which also happen to be the largest owners of commercial real estate perspective, they don't see it adding much more value to their current holdings versus what they could take liquidity for now and redeploy. So we call that capitulation. Some might be stating that the bid-ask gap in the investment sale market is narrowing, whatever you want to call it. But we are seeing that beginning to occur in the first quarter. So that means you'll have more supply in the market to price at market pricing, not a pricing exercise. The second thing that's occurring is the realization that you will have a settling of the 10-year bond at some number. Doesn't really matter what it is, just settling. And a normalization of the yield curve at some point in time, it means the likelihood you can continue to invest in a two-year treasury and get a 5 over an extended period of time is likely not a smart long-term investment thesis. So they need to start thinking about jumping into the market and where does that make sense, particularly in hard assets in today's environment. So where does that make sense? So we're seeing a little bit of this light switch type effect of capital, particularly institutional capital, coming off the sidelines and beginning to invest into the market in much greater amounts than we've seen in the last 18 months. So what does that all mean? We'll see if it closes, but we're seeing more significant activity this first quarter than we've seen in quite some time.
Yeah, I mean, in our law firm, we're certainly seeing an uptick in transactional activity across all sectors within real estate, all asset classes. We have yet to see the institutions come in at the level that they obviously were in before the downturn. But you're seeing evidence of the institutions deploying capital in a meaningful way.
Yeah, I couldn't have said that 45 days ago, Andrew, mm-hmm. but I can say it now.
Yeah, and that's when we met 45, you know, mid-February.
Yeah. So there's now evidence of that occurring, and you know, we're pricing, you know, hundreds of billions daily in the marketplace. So we're a reasonable proxy. So we see a lot of data and we see some trends. Now, again, we'll see if it actually moves through to a closing. So at this point, we're talking about pricing. We're talking about product on market and awarding transactions, which is great. We're seeing our debt activity pick up, and maybe that's another topic that would help the transactional volumes in the marketplace. Simply because debt spreads have compressed fairly dramatically since last November. Depending upon which tranche we're talking about, it could be upwards of 100 basis points in the debt space alone, which is nearing. It's not quite there, but call it neutral leverage. But you can see your way to that point. And we begin to see banks actually coming back into the market that heretofore were not, but we are now beginning to see that happen. So the debt market is also helping foster this bid-ask, you know, meet-in-the-middle type situation occurrence or the capitulation side of it, and we think it's going to help us transactionally as the year progresses.
Yeah, you know, a couple. I would say at the end of 23, so December timeframe, if you were to ask folks, they would have predicted that the Fed would likely reduce rates at least, I don't know, 3-4. I even heard maybe even up to 6 times. And then as we got through the first quarter, it was, it's probably going to be 3 times. And now on CNBC earlier this morning, it may only be 1-3 times that they may reduce. I don't know if you have an opinion on what you think the Fed is going to do. Who knows what the Fed is going to do? But I guess my question is really, whether it's 1, 2, 3 times, the people who I'm talking to, they're saying it's not going to have enough, the rate reductions are not going to have a significant enough of an effect on one's ability to refinance out of their current situation, especially the variable interest rate loans that people got into in 2021.
So I'll address those two questions. One is, I don't have the competency to tell you what the Fed's going to do, so I really don't have an opinion on whether it's 1 to 3 or whatever it may be. The Fed is very aware. We do meet with them. And I would tell you that they're very aware that their data lags. So they're trying to get more on the front foot and talk to people in the business community regularly to discern what is really happening in the marketplace. And ironically, you have some inexplicable things happening of significant corporate layoffs on the one hand, but on the other hand, you have government funded Build Back Better and other jobs. So it's an interesting situation they find themselves in, and they're trying to navigate it as best they can. So we'll put that one aside. In terms of will it affect to the positive enough to help people refinance loans, I think was your second part of the question, Andrew. I think it depends. You know, it. My general view of this is, aside from office, office is a separate topic. Generally, real estate self-corrects in a normalized yield curve environment, depending upon how far down the short end of the curve comes for almost every product type, because the primary issue we have is not, to date, demand. The issue to date has simply been loan resizing or rebalancing and derivative contract expirations. So those are both mitigated by a yield curve normalizing. And the question is, over what period of time and what is the amount there? So I think it remains to be seen, but I think any drop in that would give the market quite a bit of comfort.
Yeah, I mean, we're the clients that we work with and we're talking to, especially in the multifamily side, you know, over the last, I don't know, several months, the our involvement has been, you know, modifying existing loans, getting additional term, extending the rate cap, hoping to live another day, right? Stay alive till 25. And the concern that clients have is, do we spend, you know, multiple seven figures in extending a rate cap, extending for another 12 months, if the light at the end of the tunnel is not going to, we're not going to be able to get home free.
Yep.
And it's hard. There is no easy answer. Each deal stands on its own, but that is a microcosm of the many conversations in the multifamily world that we are seeing.
Let's take that for a second.
Yeah. Because
what you just described is actually a process getting to capitulation,
mm-hmm.
right? Of going, well, look, if I'm not going to do this, I might as well just go ahead and either give it back, sell the note, the bank can sell the note or whatever it may be, or there'll be a different solution in some form or fashion. So that in and of itself, your narrative is fueling transactional flow into the marketplace. I do want to make a statement. The banks have every tool they had in 08, 09 to modify and help borrowers who are current and otherwise good standing, good track record history, et cetera, with property that makes sense to do what they need to do to extend and move through. And I think they will do that. It's going to be dependent upon the assets and et cetera. But I think what you just went through is exactly what's happening in the U.S. And as you know, the trigger, you know, and I'm a little more focused on volumes because we need to get marks in the marketplace for a host of reasons, meaning sales, so people can benchmark appropriately to it. So I think the more that we get this transactional activity, the better. But the debt market is actually the catalyst for it, for exactly what you're talking about. That is the built-in governor to make things something trade one way or the other, generally speaking.
Look, and all of my clients are asking me, you know, what distressed opportunities are you seeing? And I start with office, and then they say, okay, next. But we have done quite a few note acquisitions in the office space at significant discounts. There have been some multifamily short sales, but the product type that we do the most is multi. But the distressed deals in multi are infinitesimal compared to the distressed deals that we are working on in office. Yet there's very little institutional capital that want to go into office despite how distressed these prices are. So I guess my question is, a lot of these funds and a lot of these groups that are sitting on the sidelines waiting for the distress, especially in multifamily, is that day going to come where they're going to be able to pick up these properties for cheap? Or because there's so much capital on the sidelines, the pricing is never going to fall that dramatic, because there will be a group that says, okay, I'm ready to come back into the market, and therefore that sets the floor. But it's not nearly as low as maybe people have anticipated.
Our view of that is, you know, we've been involved in over $20 billion of loan sales in the last 100 days, primarily office or associated office that are part of that, which in and of itself is a departure from previous cycles where lenders would foreclose and we would go through a little different process. Today, they're much more keen to sell the paper into the marketplace, or to your point, short sell it, right? I think the distress in multi or industrial or retail or manufactured housing will be limited. We'll call it tactical opportunities for the buy side, but I think it will be limited, generally speaking, simply because you have demand. There is a reason to invest, generally speaking, more capital depending upon when you bought. And the question really is one of your financial structure to begin with. So if you're over-levered and, you know, you have multiple tranches of debt in a capital stack, the likelihood of something happening there in a distressed environment are pretty high today, Andrew. On the flip side, if you're not and you're reasonably levered, I think it's unlikely. So that's why we're calling it office. I think you'll see distress at scale because we're actually doing it. But the rest of commercial, generally speaking, on commercial real estate, there are exceptions. I think it's going to be much more tactical or limited that you will see there. I will tell you, though, you made a statement about capital formation into office. We're at the forefront of institutional capital returning to office because they just believe it's oversold. Mm-hmm. So we're beginning to see the first green shoots or glimmers of what I would call significant capital, institutional capital, beginning to formulate an entrance into the marketplace again.
Any particular locations?
Well, we're in the middle of it currently, but it varies based upon the style and the strategy of the group. So there's not a sound bite that I could give you, but I can give you barbells. So on the one hand, let's go to fast growth markets that have significant population employment growth, and the employment growth is based upon industries where we see the most significant upside over the next 10 years. Let's go make a bet there. Obviously, it has to be new product. It has to be amenitized either itself or within a community that's highly amenitized. all of those things have got to line up, and that's where they're targeted. On the flip side, you have many doing the exact opposite and going into gateways in choosing very similar assets that are high quality assets and given markets, but highly amenitized, et cetera, but they're making the bet exclusively on gateway for a completely different rationale. So it's hard for me to specifically state the locations because we're seeing it both ways.
Sure. You know, I'm in Los Angeles, and for the last 10 years, I would say the majority of my transactions were not in Los Angeles, not in California, and specifically in 2021, when there was a high volume of transactional activity, it was throughout the Sun Belt, Vegas, Phoenix, throughout Texas, Florida, Nashville, Atlanta, Carolinas. And now I'm hearing sentiment that those markets have been overbuilt, yet we still have a housing crisis. So I'm not sure how the two juxtapose each other. But I'm getting more of a feedback and sentiment from clients that they are trending away from those Sunbelt communities, heading back to perhaps the coastal markets, LA, New York, upper Midwest, and other markets where that have been in disfavor over the last several years. Are you seeing a trend like that now?
I wouldn't call it a trend, but I would tell you that is happening. And the reason it's happening is you have supply headwinds in the fast growth markets for obvious reasons,
right? Sure.
And you don't have that in your gateways for also obvious reasons. And the rent increases that were experienced over the last 5 years in the fast growth markets are dramatically higher than what occurred in the gateways. So if you're an investor and you think there's going to be equilibrium getting back to a market determinant rent in a gateway to justify new construction at some point in time, then that's a good bet. From an investment standpoint, to go into a gateway and ride up this lack of supply, we call it a J curve, where you have supply constraint, but yet you have reverse in-migration coming into some of the gateways, it's a good play today.
Yeah.
And you'll see it in the public REIT filings. So if you go look at the various REITs that are primarily domiciled in gateways, you'll see them outperforming some of the traditional REITs domiciled in the fast growth markets for that very reason. But it's primarily supply driven. It doesn't mask the effect of population and employment shifts. So we just need to make that clear. That's why I'm careful to not call it a trend.
Mm, understand, but it's certainly noticeable. Yeah. We help clients match up developers with capital as well. And it is seemingly increasingly difficult to source capital for ground up development deals. What is your opinion of the capital that's out there for ground up construction? Because the reaction that I get from capital providers is, why am I going to put money into a ground up deal when I can buy a relatively new vintage property at below what it costs to build?
That's a great point. So the answer to your question is, so in our book, which we haven't talked about, we're the largest provider of equity for to-be-built industrial and multi-housing projects, okay? And that's just a reflection of what is really happening with all the merchant builders and others in the marketplace. So with supply diminishing because return on cost hurdles can't be met, so think about a 6.5 to a 7, closer to a 7, okay, which is very difficult to find, even though construction costs are beginning to come in the multi-space, industrial a little more. It's still difficult to find numbers that work on an untrended basis. So you're definitely going to have a supply drop-off. I mean, it is factual. And therefore, a lot of investors are going, well, look, if that is the case, yes, it makes a lot of sense to go buy relatively new product at discounts to replacement costs, no doubt. And you're seeing them do that, which was part of our opening commentary at the beginning. However, when you start looking at the need, and you made a comment for housing, so how do we square that when you have oversupply?
Sure.
The question is, what kind of housing and where? So that is the real question. So differentiated housing that is meeting a different need than maybe what is there is being targeted currently in the marketplace. But a lot of investors are beginning to think about that 26, 27. If supply continues along its way and we look historically at trend lines, you're generally well served to be a first mover on new supply coming to market when you begin to see the old supply absorbed, because there is a shortage of housing units. The question is, you need to get that mix correct and you need to get the location correct.
Yeah.
Well, we're beginning to see that come back around. But to your point, it is very difficult to get anything new. When I say new, buying a piece of land today and getting things done today, not taking something you've owned, discounting it back, and you had something already done.
And then the counter argument to those who are fearful or not wanting to get into ground up, of course, this is the argument from the developer side, is that because it's so hard to build these days from a capital perspective, in 2-3 years, there will be a lack of supply. So this is when you want to build.
Well, and we're beginning to see some investors do that. And our book is beginning to come back from where it was. And, you know, I think generally speaking, well, you can look at all the national supply numbers out there. But I think when you talk to the largest merchant builders, I mean, they're off dramatically. So it's a very good point. It's a good investment thesis for an investor to start taking a look at it now, even if you're not at the 7, but you may be at 6.5. Again, depending upon where you see the long-term rate stabilizing.
And then, you know, one other common theme that I'm seeing from capital providers is their desire to be in the preferred equity space when they can get equity type returns, you know, north of 15, even 17%. And then it's even beyond that with fees, et cetera. And therefore, because that is available to them without taking last dollar risk of being on the equity side, it's challenging to find LP capital through a joint venture structure, because those groups want to play in the preferred equity portion of the stack. Are you seeing that as well, or has that changed in the last 45 days?
Well, I think it's a valid point, number one. Number two is that probably the most liquid component capital stack in commercial real estate is preferred equity and mezz.
Sure.
So trying to get that money out has been difficult. So in scale. So it's interesting across the board, Andrew. But I don't think that in and of itself is limiting the amount of capital going into the equity stack, because there are pros and cons with preferred equity, as you know. So I think it's very, very liquid. They're just having trouble deploying it. At numbers that work, even at 85% or 80% of the capital stack. Are there opportunities out there? There are, but you just have, it's difficult to pencil.
Yeah. In our remaining moments, I'd actually like me personally and my attendees to learn, or my audience to learn more about you personally.
That's the most uninteresting part of this discussion, Andrew.
Oh, maybe to you, but I guess one, I'd like to know, what do you as CEO of JLL Capital Markets Americas do on a day-to-day level? And then, how did you get to this position? What is your background?
Well, the simple story of how I got here was divine intervention. It's the only explanation, because I don't deserve it. I do not deserve it. So that is number one. So what do every day? We're a business model that's built on partnership and a player coach model. I don't know really how you run a great business unless you're in the business daily, executing transactions, speaking with the largest owners of capital, the largest owners of product, and understanding their needs in order to appropriately draft a strategic plan for our business to meet those needs. Mm-hmm. So the answer is I spend the vast majority of my time with our clients determining, and generally our clients are the largest, again, owners of capital and owners of product. What do you really need? What do you want to do? How can we help you? Type situations in order to best position our company for growth and prosperity. So that's where I spend most of my time. My passion is our people, ironically, because of our culture and a team construct. So making sure we take all this data from, we're pricing approximately, certainly over 150 billion every day in some form or fashion. So how do we take that and disseminate it down to make sure all of our folks have as much current information as a differentiator in the marketplace? Because what really matters is your knowledge and the ability to execute in today's environment. So that is where I spend most of my time. How I got here is a long and twisted tale, but the short answer is I've actually been at this company that myself and a few other folks helped found going on 40 years. So it just tells you I'm unemployable otherwise. So I am... I'm one of those few folks that actually wrote the check to start the business, funded deficits, and in the interim have started multiple companies within our own company. And we've been through a few mergers ourselves. We've sold the company a couple of times. We've bought it back a couple of times. We've taken it public, and we merged with JLL in 2019. So it's been an interesting road, a great ride. Been a phenomenal career. Very blessed.
No, that's amazing. I mean, in this day when longevity is few and far between, when it comes to people's, I don't say loyalty, but people tend to bounce around a lot more. And when someone stays at a company for just 5 years, it's seen as a long time. And so to have founded, be part of the founding partners of this company and have seen it grow on a global scale, and the reputation and credibility that you and your organization have throughout the industry is really a testament to you and to your colleagues. And that's why how I started our conversation, that people both at the YPO conference, and I'm sure my listeners are extremely excited to be able to hear your thoughts. I truly appreciate you coming on to the show. I know how busy you are, and to get your perspective is extremely meaningful. So thank you.
You bet, Andrew. It's a great privilege, and thanks for having us on there and for doing this. I think your podcast has been great.
So. Well, hopefully you can come back next year, and we'll see how the real estate market is faring.
We'll see how it turns out.
All right, Mark.
Great rest of the year.
You've been listening to Real Talk, Real Estate Discussions with Andrew Kirsch. You can catch prior episodes at scholarkirsch.com and on YouTube, LinkedIn, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and more. Thank you for your positive reviews, comments, and for sharing the show with others.